Chad, it's Halloween.
Caitlin, it's Halloween.
And wow. You know what Halloween calls for? Parties.
It does. Yes, many parties. And in this case, a singular party. Welcome to the pre-read episode of Halloween Party. This is Poro Pals. I'm Chad.
And I'm Caitlin.
And so this is the pre-read episode, which is a spoiler-free zone, correct?
Yeah, in the pre-read episodes, we're here to prepare you to read the Poirot book of our choice. You could listen to this before you read, then take the time to read the book and listen to our debrief, or you can just listen straight through if that's your thing. As we said, we're breaking our own rules, and we will get to Murder on the Links next month. But we thought we would do a little Halloween special right away.
The reason that we're doing this is because of the new Kenneth Branagh Poirot film that comes out on September 15th, which we think is based on this book. Like everyone
says it is.
They say it is. But we're like, how is it based on this book? But it's called A Haunting in Venice, and it opens September 15th. And we'll also be doing an episode about that movie.
So here we are. We are preparing you to read Halloween Party. And so to give you some perspective, I don't know if we kept it in the last episode. I think I said this was the last one she wrote, but it's not. It's the penultimate book she wrote. And then we have Poirot's Last Case, which was written way earlier. So this is like kind of later Poirot. We'll kind of go into what that means and some interesting things that are happening because of that. But if you are reading them along with us, it is a big left turn from Styles. And in this episode, we're like going to walk you through that. I don't know, even more than Styles, I feel like this pre-read episode is going to be wildly helpful in your reading experience and hopefully make it a lot more enjoyable. Because I think we learned a lot as we researched and kind of were like, what is happening with this book? A lot of the gaps were filled in, and we are hoping to do that for you.
I don't think this is possible, but what I really wish is that there was a way to research the pre-read episodes before I read the book.
Yeah.
But there's not, because you're discovering stuff as you're reading it. But it was like this one, I was like, oh, there's so much I wish I would have known contextually about what's happening. Yeah. And I don't disagree with your concept of this book being a big turn from Styles, but I think it's a right turn, if you know what I mean, instead of a left turn.
Okay. So yes. Yeah. I would say that as well. And you'll see what we mean in a bit. But we did want to start out with something kind of exciting. And I think out of many of the books, and I'm sure there will be more that we come across, I think you can solve this mystery. Styles, I think, is impossible. It's just so hard to like understand what all the clues mean. And in this one, there is one clue, and we want to have you on the lookout for it. And you can basically figure out who did it. And that's exciting. And so we want you to be on alert, and we believe in you. One of the most jarring parts of the book, but also fun and weird and bizarre, is that really, the book seems to have a couple different sections that have really specific tones and themes and paces and language, and they're completely different. And I wish that someone had prepared me for it, because it is a little jarring to read. But also, when the book lags, you had done a really good job, Chad, of saying, this part will end, and then you'll get to this other part, and it will speed up. And that gave me some help along the way. So we want to explain to you the different sections of the book. Starting out, we get this really fun couple of chapters that throw us into a Halloween party. And it is smart and witty and funny and like the Agatha Christie that I love. And I was so excited when I was reading this book, because I was like, okay, this is Poirot at his best, or even just the world of the book at its best. there's just kind of chaos, but it's this really smart, fun chaos.
Yes, I thought that the first couple of chapters were very different than anything that happens in the earlier books that we've already read.
Yeah.
It was concise, but also chaotic, which was remarkable.
It has this energy to it. And I was laughing and I was like, oh my God, this is so smart. And so that lasts for three chapters. And then things slow down. And we get Poirot starting to do his investigation. And he's kind of doing this door-to-door chatting with people. And Chad, you actually identified what it was. And so I want to let you say it. What is Poirot doing in this section?
Poirot is basically trick-or-treating. Yes. He's going from door to door asking people about things concerning something that happened.
The thing that was a bit hard to work through and kind of surprising was that it's really just kind of like sitting in people's living rooms. And I kind of felt like after a big meal and you're just in a living room and you want to go home and it's really hot and someone is talking to you and you don't really want to talk to them. It felt like that for like 80 pages. The subject matter of what they're talking about is that there's a lot of bemoaning the present day. Elder generations talking about kids these days. I found it insufferable when I didn't have the context. And I was like, how have we suddenly gone from this just youthful, vibrant, hilarious part to then just the drawing room?
I did feel like I was being dragged along to a series of things I didn't want to be a part of by my aging uncle.
Yes.
There was just this feeling of like, God, do we have to? And there are so many things that are hammered home that, for lack of a better term, are completely against my beliefs and sensibilities. Different things that are just stated about the youth in the late 60s and not really talking about the amazing brilliance and vibrance and incredible just burst of energy that came from that period of time, which is a total reaction to World War II, right?
Yeah.
Like these kids are just like, these people have had two world wars. These are the adults. Screw them. And they just went nuts. But this is the opposite of that.
Yeah.
This is the adults being like, what the hell is happening in the world? And it goes on, like you said, for 80 pages.
And then suddenly we enter into this haunted garden and it gets really ethereal and philosophical. And we start getting all these analogies to mythology. We just kind of float in to this world.
And now the pace in the garden just dissipates.
Yeah.
It's almost like it doesn't exist. It's just like you're in this place and, you know, I don't want to give away too much stuff, but there's also, at the core of that is kind of a relationship between two people that even in that part of the book, to me, felt a little creepy.
Oh, yeah.
And so it's just got that all of those hallmarks of that weird, like you said, mythological, that period of time in Britain where there were cults supposedly yeah. and all these. Well, it is just like it has that feel to it.
Just be prepared to be wildly uncomfortable in many different ways. And it's not in like a fun Halloween way. And so then in the last part, there's this moment where it's like, oh, right, we're in a murder mystery. Things start happening and stakes are really high and it's life or death again. It's very surreal and very minimalist. We almost end at like a modern art museum. It's like Jackson Pollock takes Poirot and gives us a painting. And right. That's where we are. What a journey you're about to embark on.
Yeah. I will say this. It is a much breezier read.
Yes.
Given everything that we've just said than Styles was. It is not as convoluted. And I will go as far to say that once it picks up again, I think the mystery is worth the trip. For me, it was.
Yeah.
Because it is an interesting way that it ends. And we'll get into that during the debrief. Yeah.
I don't know what to make of it as a Halloween book. But we're going to try to make it as Halloween-y and fun for you as possible.
Yes. Yes, we are.
Something that's also just exciting about this is that it introduces the character Ariadne Oliver, who is a mystery writer. And she's fun because she's an older woman who is a famous mystery author who has a specific detective she's kind of annoyed about. And so she, in a way, kind of seems to be a stand-in for Agatha Christie putting herself in the books. But Ariadne Oliver is such a breath of fresh air. She's always comedic relief. And something I really like about her is that she's scattered and really smart at the same time. And I love the combination of the two. It's really refreshing. It kind of shows that you can embody silliness and intelligence and also success in one character. She always makes every book she's in way better.
This is the first time I'd ever read a book with her character in it. And I found it to be completely refreshing. Yeah. And also very different than Hastings. Mm-hmm. Because she's like very smart. Mm-hmm. And Hastings is, well, you know.
Let's get into some of the historical context behind what this book was responding to. This book has a kids these days attitude. And honestly, I would challenge you to count the amount of times every character says nowadays. Like, well, nowadays we do. And it's just, it's every other page in that section. But it is a little justified because a lot of things are changing. And Agatha Christie did say that she wrote this book as a response to a lot of the news articles and current events that she was seeing and trying to process them and like understand them and come to terms with the world that she was living in. So the 1960s, and maybe like the long 1960s, basically sees the invention of the teenager. It's kind of a new concept. I feel like kind of beforehand, you're a child and then suddenly you're an adult. Mm-hmm. And now we have these kids. So young people finally have a lot of freedom and a lot of time that kids didn't have before. Like they weren't working, they weren't going to war. They were able to enjoy their youth. And with that comes just a culture, an attitude, and then also what happens when kids have a lot of time on their hands.
The other thing too is that, I mean, we don't have to get into the reasons why, because they're very obvious, but this group of people is population-wise larger than anyone else. The streets are just teeming with kids.
Yes. Yeah. And also they've been raised by two traumatized generations. Yeah. That like haven't dealt with their war trauma. So there's a lot of messed up stuff going on in these houses. And the Historic UK has this really nice quote about the wild child's life. They say, at weekends or during school holidays, it was quite normal for a child to go out and play after breakfast, return for a quick lunch, and not to be seen again until tea time. When as often or not, they would arrive home with scraped knees and torn or muddy clothes. And that kind of explains to you, there are just a lot of free range children in this book.
Yep.
That was also some of the like discomfort. Who's watching these kids? And it's pretty normal. So teenagers, they also have pocket money for the first time. They're spending money on like going to the movies and all this new music that's coming out and comic books. So counterculture and pop culture is spreading really quickly. So there's like this sense of teenagers being able to communicate with each other and be into things together in a way that they hadn't really before. And with that, there comes these two specific styles, I would say, of fashion, music, and culture, especially in the UK. And we get the mods and the rockers. Do you want to kind of explain the difference between the two, Chad?
Sure. I always feel like a lot of the rockers sort of thing came from the US in the 50s with Brando and motorcycles and the Wild One. And it definitely traveled across seas. And so I think a large group of the kids broke off into this rowdy motorcycle, leather wearing, big, huge sideburns type of thing. And rumors were they would take over towns and things. And that wasn't really true, but that was the vibe back then.
Yeah.
And the other side of it was the mods, who were fashion and music, and what you had said, velvet. They wear, yeah, a lot of velvet for sure. But then at the top of the velvet jacket is a floofy collar or scarves.
Yeah.
Think about The Who in 1966 or 67. Yeah. That type of energy where the fashion and the it just like the music, the explosion of all of this. And you could see why people would be freaked out about it if you were like 75 years old, right? Yeah. Or whatever.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. And like, as we have these feral children running around, we also have this huge upswing in violence. They're concurrent. And I think some of it does have to do with angry men coming home from wars, not knowing what to do with their lives. And also like just social changes. I was talking to Priyesh yesterday and he was like, well, yeah. And also immigration is starting to really pick up. So there's a lot of xenophobia and tension around like newcomers coming into the UK and classes are changing. And so there's just with this influx of change and counterculture, there's a lot of violence. Just to kind of put it in perspective, there was a survey, it was cited in the Mirror, so like, let's take it with a grain of salt, but it was from 2008, and it said that kids in 1968 were twice as likely to carry a knife with them, and the number of violent attacks and sexual assaults by 2008 had dropped by half in 40 years. And I think that's what Agatha Christie is seeing, and that's what she based a lot of the events in this book on, is news stories about this rise in crime and almost feeling helpless.
I don't know that much about the actual statistics, but I remember hearing all of those stories about how the establishment just completely overreacted. Yeah. Constantly to everything. Mick Jagger and Keith Richards get whatever, they have like a little bit of hashish on them, and then they are going to be maybe sentenced for like 10 years of prison or something. All of the things that I admire from that time are so antithetical to the book.
I mean, and it's crazy to think about Agatha Christie, who I think is such a like fussy, stuffy product of the 1920s, trying to come to terms with this and just being like, where does Poirot fit into this world? We get Halloween Party. That's where he fits in. It just feels like no one was equipped to handle anything, whatever generation you are. And so there's a lot of talk of mental health issues in the book. A lot of the old mental health institutions and psychiatric hospitals in the UK were getting shut down because they were too expensive. And so the government was closing a lot of them. And so people were having to really rethink, what do we do with people who need this kind of help? And it sounds like there wasn't really an alternative.
When I was reading the book, the feeling that I had was from that perspective, from the perspective of maybe not so much Poirot, but all of Poirot's friends, and certainly the feeling from, I believe, the author herself, is that it's not coming back. It's gone. That period of time where these halcyon days of how wonderful everything was, and yeah, there might have been problems, but it's nothing like there is today. You get the feeling that they are adrift.
Yeah.
They don't know what to make of what's happening. But the thing that's so interesting about that is that this book came out in the late 60s, right? Like 69?
Yeah.
So that means we are basically 8 years away from Thatcherism.
Yeah.
In the UK, which is a total authoritarian grab. It's just so interesting to think that people felt they had lost this culture and society, but then that definitely came back for it. And you could argue it's still there now.
Yeah. And so lastly, like along with the other things that are changing, women's roles are changing too. And I think this is kind of expressed. There's some tension and also backlash. And I'll kind of go into this more in the debrief of what it means to be a girl and what it means to be a woman. And it's kind of exactly as you were describing, Chad, that there's a lot of people like trying to control these ideas and these cultural expectations, when the reality is there's so much more like freedom and new thoughts and ideas. In my head, I call them like the vile adults are trying to just contain it. And say, like, this is how you're supposed to be a girl, you know, a little girl. Spoiler alert, it's a lot of things you shouldn't be doing that are completely contradictory.
Right.
This is when we get the introduction of the pill. Clothing is more freeing. And people are just, women especially, are imagining their lives beyond the domestic sphere. That's exciting, but again, equally terrifying. For the older generations, they just don't know what to make of it. And so you can really see that in this book.
I read a review of this that said something like, looking at it from maybe in a slightly different angle than we are, just kind of shocked reading it that Agatha Christie used the word lesbian.
Yeah.
So that's another reviewer reading it who's kind of feels the same way that Christy does. Is like, whoa, she's being so progressive.
Yeah.
She's using this word. There's so many different ways to look at it.
And that's kind of where we can, I think maybe we can send readers out on like a little mission as you're reading. Who is the hero in this? Mm-hmm. Is it kind of leaning more towards these newer, younger, more open people? Is it less these like stuffy oldies, I guess? I don't know if I can say that. It's just very ambivalent. See who you think the hero is by the end of the book. So we're going to move away from all of this historical context, social upheaval, and go to something a little bit more fun. Chad, you're going to help walk us through that first party scene.
When I was reading the opening chapters, I love them so much. But there are two specific games that are played by the children during the Halloween party. And they are very much kind of just described matter-of-factly, as if perhaps you had played them in your life. And I never had played either of these games. Had you played?
No. I knew Bobbing for Apples, and I could pick up on the broomstick decorating contest. I was like, I think I understand what's going on. And then she named these, and there are some really complex rules. So tell us about them, Chad.
So the first one is a game called Snapdragon. And Snapdragon was a traditional Christmas parlor game. What it was is that while you were having your Christmas dinner, towards the end of the evening, the adults in the room, the vile adults, would bring out this large serving dish that was covered in raisins that had some type of alcohol or liquor drizzled over them. Brandy was, it was the one that came up the most. What would happen was the adults would light the raisins on fire, and then the kids would put their hands through the flames, pick out a raisin and eat it. And the idea was to get as many raisins as you could before the flames went down.
Oh my God.
And so it seemed like it was something that a lot of kids looked forward to. So when it happens in the book, it's like a big deal. The first references to the game can be found in the 1500s, when it was also called Flapdragon. Snapdragon is referenced in Shakespeare's Love's Labour's Lost.
Oh.
I do not know exactly where, but it is. Also in the 1870s, Lewis Carroll, in Through the Glass Darkly, he creates a fantastical creature called a snapdragonfly and describes it as its body is made of plum pudding with wings of holly leaves, its head a raisin burning in brandy. This is obviously a big cultural thing. The game was meant to be played in near darkness to enhance the sense of risk and danger and spookiness.
Mm.
Caitlin, it turns out there's an accompanying poem.
Oh my God.
This was a poem that accompanied the playing of the game. When the flame was lit, the children would chant, "Here comes the burning bowl. Don't he mean to take his toll? Snip, snap, dragon. Take care you don't take too much. Be not greedy in your clutch. Snip, snap, dragon. With his blue and lapping tongue, many of you will be stung. Snip, snap, dragon. For he snaps at all that comes, snatching at his feast of plums. Snip, snap, dragon. But old Christmas makes him come, though he looks so fa-fa-fum. Snip, snap, dragon. Don't ye fear him, but be bold. Out he goes, his flames are cold. Snip, snap, dragon." And so the kids are playing that frantically while they're chanting, and usually the game itself just lasts as long as them saying that poem. By the end of it, the flames are out. So it's like a whole thing, right? It makes sense that it's where it is in the book.
And I love that there is an element of danger and that kids are literally sticking their hands in fire.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And like once they get it, it's actually good for them because raisins are a great source of fiber. So it works out. And then the other one is the mirror game.
Ooh, this is creepy.
The mirror game in the book is basically they would darken the room and then the girls, one at a time, would go to gaze into a mirror. In the reflection of the mirror behind them, they would either see the face of their future husband or a skeletal face, which means that they could face an early death.
Oh my God.
Which is horrifying.
Two options.
The thing I think is like important about it and kind of is really spooky is that it's a form of something that I think we've all heard of things like this. I didn't know the actual term for it, which is called scrying.
Mm.
The game Bloody Mary is okay, a version of it. If you go a little bit further with it, it's the concept of looking into a potentially mirrored image to see the past or the future. And that also includes water, because that's a mirror image too. Nostradamus used to practice it. He would stare into a bowl of water or a magic mirror to see the future while he was in a trance, which is, sure, I'm sure we've got that documented.
Yeah.
Also, it's a mention in the Old Testament. It's also in the Latter-day Saints movement where they use something called seer stones, which are similar to the concept of scrying. But this is the thing. So you and I, Caitlin, have been banging our heads on the wall trying to figure out how the hell they're going to make a movie out of Halloween Party.
I know.
I think it's scrying. I think it's the mirror game, because in every one of the trailers, it shows mirrors and water as potential gateways to the supernatural.
Yeah.
So I think that could be the thing.
And I was thinking maybe the magic garden can be interesting too. We're very interested to see how this odd little book becomes a 2023 movie that anybody would want to see. So Kenneth Branagh, our hats off to you. We're excited to see what happens.
Yes, this decidedly landlocked book becomes a movie that takes place in Venice.
I know, yeah. And I'm like, are kids involved? As always, we want to give you all just some like tips for how to read the book. First of all, it's a great book to read during the Halloween season, for sure. I think you do have to bring your own spookiness to it. The first part really carries the spookiness for you, but you make it as autumnal as you can. Light a scented candle. Read it at night. Wear black. You can make it as Halloween-y as you want.
I would say also definitely have like a little bowl of apples near you. Apples just to have a nice thing to munch on. I would also highly recommend while you're reading it, if you have a speaker in your room or if you read with earbuds or headphones on, try the amazing Halloween Party playlist that Caitlin has made for this. It's on Spotify. We'll put a link to it in. It's fantastic.
Yeah, it's fun. I tried to just get spooky ambient music, and it's much less based on what happens in the book and more getting into the Halloween vibes. I tried to do some playful ones and then some more like traditional spooky-ooky ones. And also like Poirot actually, he drinks brandy in this one, which I'm surprised by because usually he doesn't drink alcohol. I think his kids these days have driven him to drink. So a good apple brandy, I don't know, kind of warm you up. An apple cider, yes, spiced apple cider. I do recommend, if you do want to breeze through it, the Hugh Fraser audiobook is great. With that one, take it on a nice little autumnal walk. Go out into nature, go out into like a public garden even. That would be so fun. Or if you have a pea patch in your neighborhood, listen to it while you're outdoors. And I think it could be very satisfying. A brisk, foggy morning.
Yeah, get your flannel on, get outside.
Lastly, we did want to leave you with, there are some really hilarious reviews, how this book was received. And we just kind of wanted to set you up for that. When it came out, people even then were like, we don't really like it. And I have a quote from the Toronto Star from a review by Robert Weaver. And he says, Halloween Party is a disappointment. But with all her accomplishments, Miss Christie can be forgiven some disappointments. Poirot seems very weary, and so does the book. But I did want to say, and I found this a couple places where they were saying that the book ends up being seen several decades later. People start to open up to it, which really surprised me. And so I have this review from The Independent. Let me see who wrote it. Joe Lewin from The Independent in 2015 says, the reason this is such a good novel, the most read one on my bookcase, is because it's a perfect blend of dark humor and the macabre murders of a serial killer and the unpredictable plot that she creates, which I was like, whoa, that's generous. He does say that the book is very weird, but he ends his review by saying that if you're going to read one Agatha Christie book, you should read this one.
Wow.
Okay, that's a strong opinion. Mr. Lewin.
I hope I get there someday.
Right? Yeah. He says, if you're a newcomer to the work of the Queen of Crime, then I do suggest you begin with his book. Halloween Party is the epitome of 20th century crime novels and one of her finest and most thought-provoking works.
Okay. Wow. We have been critical of the book without giving away any spoilers, but we have also given some positive reviews. Mm-hmm. And how many times in your life do you have a chance to read a character over 49 years mm-hmm. or whatever it is?
Yeah.
We started in 1920 and now it's 1969, written by the same author. This isn't fan fiction. This is the same person writing the same character, writing mysteries. That's just awesome.
Read the book. Tell us what you think. Solve the mystery. Who's the hero? Anything else?
I think that's it. I think we're good.
Cool.
All right. See you at the debrief.
Bye.